Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the political brain with Emory Professor Drew Weston. With the political season upon us, it seemed a good time to bring in a local gem, a local resource. Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry Drew Weston, who is also the author of the new book, The Political Brain. Much to the shock of an academic, Weston's book was reviewed almost everywhere and has received an extraordinary amount of attention, not what your typical academic psychologist expects. Drew Weston, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, The Political Brain. This is a book by an academic psychologist, which seems to have touched a nerve. What did you expect would happen with this book, and what actually happened?
I expected that it would probably sit on library shelves in the library near you, and that it would hopefully over the course of maybe 10 years get picked up by political people, and I'd start getting an occasional phone call here and there.
And in fact, what happened?
Well, the phone calls have been more than occasional. They've been from people I never would have expected. If you had said to me a year ago that I would be getting, you know, calls from presidential candidates or campaigns or from senators or from party leaders, I would probably have asked you what it is that you're smoking, and I would never, of course, buy such a thing from you, but I might I might ask you where you got it.
So, let's start at the beginning. Okay, you decided to do some research. What is it that you decided to do, and how did you decide to do it? And how did this evolve?
Well, you know, it's funny. My background, my major area of research for years has been in personality and personality disorders. And I guess you can see a logical leap from personality disorders to politicians, so that's kind of easy. narcissistic personality disorder, maybe. But the real thing that happened was about, I guess it was almost a decade ago when the impeachment stuff started with Bill Clinton. If we really go back to where my interest in wedding politics and psychology began, was I remember watching Pat Buchanan on one of these shows like Crossfire, or it might have been on one of the morning news shows This Week, or when it was with whoever it was with back then, you know. And the story had just broken about, what was her name, the woman who claimed that Bill Clinton had groped her in the Oval Office.
There were several of those.
Okay. Kathleen Willey. Willey. And the next Sunday morning, the shows were abuzz about this 60 Minutes or 2020 interview she had done. And the question was, you know, whether it had really happened. And Pat Buchanan was saying, you know, this is a women's issue. This is a civil rights issue. And I remember thinking, boy, when Pat Buchanan's talking about women's and civil rights issues, it's time to bring in the shrinks. So I started to study how it was that people came to believe what they believed in politics. And we did a series of studies over the course of the year that led to Clinton's impeachment, where we were studying what actually predicted things like whether people believed that his actions constituted high crimes and misdemeanors, the definition for an impeachable offense under the Constitution.
So now there's this neat new tool, the fMRI, the functional MRI. What is that, and how did that play into the research that is the basis for the book, The Political Brain?
Okay, so what I told you was from 1998, and I started doing a series of studies that were trying to predict things like which way would people go on the question of whether they believed in 2000, in those months when the election was still disputed, those couple of months, several weeks in November and December, when the election was still disputed, you know, what would predict whether they would believe that either manual or machine counts were more valid? And, you know, you'd watch these pundits get on, and they really seemed to believe themselves when they'd say, well, there's every reason to believe that, you know, that manual counts are more accurate. They more accurately describe the will of the people. And it turned out that if you heard a Democrat speak, the Democrat would say with utmost conviction that clearly a manual count is the most, really tells you what the will of the people is. You'd listen to the Republican, he'd say with incredible conviction, clearly the machine counts are more accurate. So then came the 2004 election. And What an fMRI is, a functional MRI is, you know, a standard MRI basically looks at your brain and says, what's going on in there? Do you see, you know, lumps? Do you see water where there should be water? And do you see gray matter where there ought to be gray matter?
But they're still photographs.
Yes.
Essentially, they're slices of a brain at that particular second that it takes the image,
that's
the scan.
Right. That's right. With functional MRI, what you do as opposed to what's called structural MRI, which tells you about your brain structure, what functional MRI does is you do something to the person and you see what the brain does. You know, you do
in real time.
In real time, and you basically watch it jump. You know, you say to the brain, jump, and you see what jumps in the brain. And that's where we really had an opportunity to understand what happens when partisans are confronted with threatening information about their candidate. Do we see what all the theories tell us in politics should be the case, which is that, you know, when voters are presented with arguments or with data, do they process the data in something resembling a rational way? Or do they do what we suspected that they would do, which is they process it primarily with their gut, with their emotions? Reason is way, way in the background.
You expected that, and in fact, it would be the emotional side of the brain making these political decisions based on your research, but the general perception was the opposite, correct? That people make political decisions based on rational decision making.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny when you ask, you know, what got you started in this? I didn't realize until after the book was done, and I think I was in the middle of a radio or TV interview, and I realized suddenly that 25 years ago, I did a master's thesis on the underlying psychology of the Enlightenment philosophers who essentially were the ones who inspired our Constitution, you know, the social contract philosophers. And they had this very rationalistic idea, these really rationalistic ideas. And it turns out that, you know, my book is really in many ways about how Democrats have stuck with that 18th century idea that if you just give people the right facts and figures, that they'll come to the right conclusions that meet their self-interest. Republicans actually start out with what turns out to be a much more accurate picture of how the mind and brain works, which is that people actually are swayed by their values and by their emotions, and that the data matter sometimes, kind of, but that, you know, Republicans tend to come out of business. They come from marketing backgrounds, and they understand marketing. Democrats are more likely to come from community organizing, from, you know, wearing their Birkenstocks and wearing them out while they, you know,
or working their way up through government, local or federal, state, whatever.
Absolutely. Or being in a think tank where they can use acronyms like SCHIP and convince each other. And, you know, Republicans would never take an acronym like SCHIP out in public because they understand marketing.
My guest is Professor Drew Weston, the Emory Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry, talking about his new book, The Political Brain. You cite some really great examples in the book of, in this case, Democrats totally putting out messages and using language that people cannot respond to. Actuarial this and these absurd ways where they're trying to appeal to people's minds and meanwhile completely losing their hearts.
Okay, great example. In 2000, then Vice President Gore is having his first debate with then Governor George W. Bush. They're having a discussion about Medicare. And here's how Gore appeals to the average American. He says, under the governor's plan, your rates would go up between 17 and 48%. And that's according to a study done by the Medicare actuaries.
Yawn.
Yeah. Did you feel that too, David?
I was so moved.
Well, that's that's, of course, how he tried to appeal to people. He thought, well, I'll just tell them what's in their rational self-interest. You could just see his consultants in the background going, the guy's doing debate preparation for him going, yes, he remembered the statistics. He got them right. Well, imagine if instead he had said, you know, under the governor's plan, your rates are going to go up by about a third. If you're in a fixed income, that's a lot of money. And that's not how we treat our parents and grandparents in the United States of America. It's the exact same message. 17 to 48% is a third.
Right.
You know, hand out the 17 to 48%, put it on your website, hand it out to the media. They're not going to read it anyway. They're
right.
Not interested in the numbers either, actually. You know, they're more interested in Anna Nicole Smith and, you know,
and the horse race.
And the horse race. Yeah. That's what they're interested in. They're interested in, yes, and saying to you, well, you know, it looks like you're behind by 3% today. What are you going to do about that? But, you know, if you just appeal to people's gut and get the real point across should have been, I care about the people, these people who are older and who are going to need to have some health care coverage when they're older. And that's not what he conveyed. What he conveyed was that he cared about Medicare actuaries. And you know what? The average person doesn't know what an actuary is, and they probably wouldn't like one if they did. So that's not the best way to appeal to people.
All right. So specifically with the brain scans, what exactly did you do? How did you test people?
Okay. So it was the 2004 election. It was right in the height of the election around August, September, October 2004 election between John Kerry and George W. Bush. And we presented partisan Democrats and Republicans, and we really appreciate these people participating in this study. These were people who were really activists. These were people who really cared from a Democratic Republican point of view. Let me get you to picture this. So they're lying down in a scanner, and we're presenting images to them through, smoke and mirrors. It's a series of mirrors that projects it right into their eyes, so they're reading this set of statements.
Right.
So first statement comes up, and say it's John Kerry, and says, in 1996 on Meet the Press, John Kerry said, we have to take Social Security really seriously. We've got to put everything on the table, that whether that means testing, whether that means retirement age, everything. We got to solve this because we have got a generational responsibility to our seniors. If you're a Democrat, you read that and your heart's thumping, you're going, yeah, I like this. This guy's being honest. All right, next slide comes up. John Kerry, 2004, Meet the Press says, I would never means test. We would, you know, we have a generational responsibility to our seniors to meet the obligations that we've made to them under Social Security.
The opposite of what he
said. Now, I have to say, we did slightly doctor some of these phrases, and mostly just to make them the right length. But clearly, you know, you got a reasoning task. So what we present people, next slide comes up. It says, consider Mr. Kerry's words and deeds are inconsistent. All right, so here you are. You're a partisan Kerry Democrat. You really want to like the guy. You've got A comes up, B comes up. A and B are completely contradictory, and you're asked, if A is true, can B be true? That's a basic reasoning
task.
How do you
put these two together?
And every neuroimaging study that's ever been done would tell you that what's going to be activated are reasoning circuits in the brain. They're up towards the top of the skull and the sides, kind of the coasts in the Midwest of the brain. You know, that's where you're expecting to see activation.
In other words, that they would look at these two contradictory statements and rationally conclude the guy is a hypocrite.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And what we expected was that that's not how it would happen at all. We actually expected that Democrats and Republicans would show the same kinds of biases. I mean, as a partisan, I might have wished that we'd find the Fox News center of the brain that, you know, distorts. But that's, in fact, that wish did not come true. And then we had a series of hypotheses. You know, in science, we glorify our best hunches and guesses with the name hypotheses. So what we expected was, so that, you know, the dominant models out there and all the previous data would have said that people are going to make, it's a reasoning task, we should see these reasoning circuits activated. I'll tell you what was active. The first thing that was active was a bunch of emotion circuits registering distress. This was a brain that was in distress. Second thing we see is parts of the brain that are involved in regulating emotions. That is, how do I get out of this feeling? I don't like this. What do I do to get out of this? Third thing that we see is there's a part of the brain that registers conflict. When you've got conflicting signals going on, you're trying to figure out, wait a minute, what do I do with this conflict? We probably saw the biggest activations in that part of the brain that I've ever seen in a brain imaging study. That was what was active, and the reasoning circuits of the brain were essentially the dead zone.
So the bottom line is, the political brain is what?
An emotional brain. It is not a dispassionate, cool, calculating machine that calculates our rational self-interest. The machinery of our brains have evolved over years of evolution, millions of years, actually, that we share with other primates and with other mammals. Emotions essentially serve a couple of functions. One of them is to grab our attention when something should matter to us. And the other is to pull us towards things that feel good and pull us away from things that are bad for us or our families or our communities. And there is one little hitch, and that's what this study got at, which is that our emotions can also pull us toward and away from ideas that we would rather believe or not believe. They can also make us distort data so that we are pulled towards ideas that feel good and pulled away from ideas that feel bad.
We find an emotional solution to the conflict.
You got it. You got it.